I'm Alan Brown, and I studied economics, and so I'm interested in data and how reliable it is, because often, you know, from economics, generally it's not that reliable. And I think you could say the same thing with this COVID-19 stuff as well.
Okay, so is there anything specific you'd like to point to about the statistics which needs looking at again?
Well, I mean, with most things, it goes from the definitions and then gets worse from there. The two definitions that the UK uses are the Department of Health and Social Care definition, which is any death within 28 days of a positive COVID-19 test is counted as a COVID-19 death. The other method they use is the Office for National Statistics definition, which is if COVID-19 is on the death certificate as a comorbidity, whether or not it was a cause of death, and whether or not it doesn't even need a test. So it can be on symptoms alone, which are not specific to COVID-19, which is, fairly broad. This follows from the World Health Organization definition, which ONS and the US uses. And then you lead into that problems with the testing, that they're not doing a randomized sample, so you can't make any, even if you had a good test, if you haven't got a randomized test where you're testing the same representative sample, you can't make any inferences from the testing data. It's rubbish because you get selection bias.
Okay, could you just explain what you mean by that?
Well, if you say early on in the outbreak, what they were doing was testing symptomatic people. They were testing people who went into hospital. They weren't testing general population. So you have a completely different sample back in April than you do now, when everybody and their dog is being tested, whether or not they've got symptoms. So you can't make any comparisons at all. Particularly, so if you just if you haven't got if you're not going a percentage of the same people, and you're testing much more people now, if you increase the number of tests, then you just get more positive samples. So it's rubbish. It's pointless doing it. They should have had representative sampling from the beginning all the way through. And at least the only problems then you'd have is with the test itself rather than the sampling method.
Okay, so what's the implication of all of this for the statistics we're getting, the policy that's being implemented then?
It means that you've really got no idea what the R number is, because you need for the R number, what you would need is you would need to know what percentage of the population is infectious and how that changes over time, using the same testing methods, and we don't know. And if you don't get that right, then how do you know? You've no idea how many people. Well, you haven't got a very good idea of how many people who actually have died of COVID-19, particularly when you've got a very broad definition of what was a COVID-19 death.
What's the implication for the actual policy that we're pursuing now?
That if you're making policy on the back of there's a huge outbreak of COVID-19 infections and deaths, then you can't do a cost benefit analysis of how many people you are saving supposedly from getting infected and dying of COVID-19 and becoming ill, and how many people you are damaging through the policy of lockdown. You can't make that comparison unless you've got good data for it.
And what do you make of these new variants? I mean, I thought that generally speaking, when a new disease comes along, especially if it's quite a nasty one, that when the variants start to occur, then the disease becomes less virulent, less nasty, if you want. But it seems that these new variants, when it comes to COVID, are the opposite. They're more dangerous, more transmissible, or whatever. So why is that happening? Do you know?
There doesn't seem to be any good data to say that they are more deadly, and there's very limited information with all these variants, whether they are more infectious, because it could be the lockdown itself is forcing the virus to mutate more to keep going, because what it wants to do is reproduce. If it kills the host, then it's less likely by genetic selection to propagate itself. A dead person cannot propagate COVID-19.
Well, they're not coughing and sneezing and stuff, I suppose,
no,
are they?
No.
So what is going on here then? What's your take on, take a step back from the problems with the statistics. Why are the statistics just, are the statisticians just bad statisticians, useless statisticians, or is there some sort of agenda behind this?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. So there's obviously self-interest, and there's also there's obviously financial interests with, you know, the NHS and various other health bodies representatives having investments in vaccine companies, the rest of it, and there's not wanting to admit they're wrong. Because if they turn around to public go, yeah, this has been a complete waste of time, you know, they're not going to keep their jobs, are they? People are going to be very annoyed. So they've got to keep it going. I mean, there's what they may do is reduce the cycle threshold as they roll out the vaccine and pretend that the reduction in infection and deaths is due to the vaccine. And that way they can go clean hands then.
Well, what do you mean about the cycle threshold? Explain that.
Well, a PCR test, reverse transcriptase PCR test, how it works is that you take a sample and you first of all have to change RNA, because it's an RNA virus, to DNA, and then you replicate that sample virus or bits of that virus, it's not even the entire chain, a certain number of times until you can detect it. But there's no standard number of cycles to replicate, because obviously if you replicate an unlimited number of times, obviously you're always going to get positive. And if you replicate less, you're going to have less positives. So these tests aren't comparable, because even within the country, you don't have the same cycle threshold.
Oh, so you're saying that it's a sort of postcode lottery going here, that say if you get tested in one place, you might be positive and somewhere else be negative.
Well, I mean, for instance, I think Taiwan runs quite a low cycle threshold, as far as I know. So they have less cases. Well, that's not the entire reason, but it would reduce the number of cases. Italy was running more, I think. Yeah. So it makes very difficult to compare infection rates and mortality rates if you're not even using the same test.
So if you had the ear of Sage and Nervtag, who seem to be running the country rather than Boris and the cabinet at the moment, what would you be telling them?
Well, as other people far more qualified than I have suggested, like Yeadon, Dr. Michael Yeadon, it is just to stop the testing. Is that it's you cannot track, trace and isolate a highly infectious respiratory infection once it's endemic in the population. So it's pointless. You could have done it, say, for an island like Iceland did it quite well early on, but now it's pointless. It's out in the population. You're not going to put it back in its box.
Yeah, but so what should their policy be then?
The standard Barrington Declaration thing of you protect the vulnerable, but because if you shield everybody, actually you make it does not shield the vulnerable, because essentially the disease will spread until herd immunity is reached and then fall away gradually, like Farr's law. But normally the young and healthy who have with more social contacts would take the burden of producing herd immunity before most of the vulnerable can be exposed, because they have less social contacts. If you shield everybody, actually you don't reduce the number of deaths, because what happens is you maybe extend the period to herd immunity, and it becomes more likely over the long term that the vulnerable become exposed.
What about the statistics around the eat out to help out? Because I know our esteemed colleague Martin Summers, he is convinced that this was an absolute disaster. They actually helped the virus spread around all over the place, and it should never have happened.
Well, it's difficult to see how that's the case, being as the eat out to help out was in August. And if it did increase significantly the infection rates, then you'd expect, after a time lag, deaths to change trajectory, increase the trajectory of deaths. And if you look at, say, the government's own website, deaths within 28 days of a positive test, it's flat. It's flat until autumn, until you get autumn resurgence, which you do every year. Because there's generally 18 to 23 days is what they say is the average time between infection and death. So 18 to 23 days after the introduction on the 3rd of August, there should have been an increase in the trajectory of deaths. And then 18 to 23 days after the end, i.e. 18 to 23 days after the 31st of August, there should be a decrease in the trajectory, and there's nothing. There's no...
I mean, you know what there is there was a massive increase in testing going on in September and October, a big rollout of these testing stations, etc. Many, many more people were getting tested.
Yes. And as goes overall excess mortality, which you can check against COVID-19 deaths to see if a huge spike in COVID-19 deaths is credible, is to check it against overall mortality, like Euromomo or the ONS's own data, where they do excess mortality. And on the ONS's own data, at a time when you expect other normal forms of deaths to increase during winter, heart disease, cancer, you know, strokes, you know, normal things, they decrease. While COVID-19 is so this does seem to be a problem with the data.
How can we fix it, Alan?
I don't know, to be honest. I mean, there's the other thing about kind of Euromomo data, that there is a kind of large spike in excess deaths, but this only happens from Christmas, sort of after when they were kind of screaming about second wave. So it's, you wonder whether what's happening, it's almost self-referential, what they're doing is that they go scream COVID, and introduce a lockdown, which increase excess deaths by denying people treatment for heart disease, cancer and strokes and all the rest of it. And then they say, oh, yes, see, we had to introduce lockdown, even though lockdown has killed lots of people. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, but I mean, I keep pressing you on this.
Yes.
What should we do instead?
Well, I think that the Barrington approach of shielding the vulnerable and then open up society, schools and the rest of it, because lockdown has not effectively shielded the vulnerable, and then you offer support to the vulnerable to allow them to isolate until herd immunity is reached.
Well, that is another way of doing things. I mean, one thing about lockdowns you can say is that if they did work, why are we keeping having to use them again and again and again? Obviously they don't work, and if they don't work, why are we using them in the first place?
Well, there's been academic paper after academic paper, the Lancet paper, there's East Anglia University paper, there's the Stanford paper, and some of them seem to suggest that you can slow the rate of increase of infections and sometimes deaths, but when you go to cumulative deaths, it leaves unchanged, essentially. It will just increase until herd immunity is reached.
The lockdown will stretch out the deaths, is that right?
Yes. Even hard lockdowns don't even do that, because the Stanford study, they compared voluntary kind of soft lockdowns, like sort of not having large gatherings, closing down schools and closing down high contact hospitality, which was effective, or sorry, I missed that. That was the East Anglia one. But the Stanford, what they did was compare soft lockdowns, i.e. kind of Sweden-type approach with not having large gatherings, compared to hard lockdowns, and compare the difference in kind of infection rate and death. And they found that there was no, it was little additional benefit. Only kind of soft lockdown measures were kind of effective in sort of slowing the rate of spread, if you know what I mean.
Okay, Alan Brown, thanks very much.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.